And so begins the formal part of the evening, and I mark that by saying to you, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Andrew Lynn, and I'm the Director of Research and Innovation in the Faculty of Arts and Humanities. And it's a great pleasure to welcome you to the latest in our series of professorial lectures, in which new or recently appointed professors present their work to a general audience. This lecture series predates the establishment of the Faculty of Arts and Humanities in its current form, but the series is nonetheless very much a reflection of our view that the arts and humanities are a common cause, and that all our disciplines draw on and illuminate each other. Because of this, we think it is important to get some of our brightest and most influential researchers out from behind their desks and to bring their findings to our shared research arena, the Humanities Research Institute, and this evening's talk is the latest in an impressive and memorable series. As a specialist in phonetics, the science of speech, I am in an unusually fortunate position in that I'm able to spot something which almost certainly goes unnoticed by folk without specialist linguistic training, namely that Professor Jimmy Lenman is from Scotland. Jimmy grew up in the very assuredly Scottish environs of Dundee, and having Dundee, he continued his journey through the alphabet by heading south to Oxford and St Catherine's College to turn his attentions to PPE. I used to think that PPE was like PE but for older children, but the Oxford degree in philosophy, politics and economics was in fact established in 1920 as a modern alternative to the classics, because it was felt that the classics were no longer relevant for people entering the civil service. However, government didn't beckon for young Jimmy Lenman, and it was evidently the P rather than the P or the E that appealed to him, and indeed geographically it was the N rather than the S, as he felt the pull of home and returned to St Andrews for a master's degree in moral philosophy, followed by a PhD with a thesis on realism and idealism in the theory of value. Jimmy's career then took him dangerously far south again to Lancaster before he returned to safer ground and 6 years at the University of Glasgow. Having spent a year at Harvard in 2002-2003 as fellow at the Centre for Ethics and the Professions, Jimmy clearly decided that exotic locations were for him after all, and after Harvard he moved to Sheffield. Jimmy has made huge sacrifices to bask on the sun-kissed beaches of Sheffield, being willing to languish in what the THES table of the RAE results reliably informs us is only the fourth best philosophy department in the country, satisfyingly, I dare say to Jimmy, four places above his alma mater, Oxford. From Jimmy's webpage, we learn that he works mainly on ethics and especially meta-ethics. We learn, moreover, that his recent work has dealt with issues relating to moral realism, moral expressivism, moral psychology, moral epistemology, and moral responsibility, none of which can be seen as in the least morally reprehensible. Apart from that, Jimmy's alphabetic odyssey now seems to have brought him to land on the letter C. His recent work has covered issues of compatibilism, consequentialism, contractualism, constructivism, and contingency. He evidently knows his P's from his Q's, however, and for the past 6 years he's been honoured as President of the British Society for Ethical Theory. Jimmy is a productive author, with 11 publications over the past 3 years alone, and with several grants from the AHRC behind him, one of the few members of his department not under the personal patronage of Lord Leverhulme. In preparing this brief introduction, and to try to find something about the man behind the philosophy, I made my way to Facebook, something which I joined for this benefit, in fact. I was recently told that I'd have to get familiar with Facebook if I'm ever to be able to communicate with my students again, and obviously it's the way to find out about your colleagues. I knew his Facebook entry would relate to the lighter side of Lenman, because while his university webpage goes under the name of Jimmy Lenman, his laid-back Facebook persona is James Lenman. When not burning the midnight light bulb in the Arts Tower, Jimmy can be found striding through the mountains and hills, proving the adage that Sheffield may have its charms, but it is above all a great place to get out of. His second interest after philosophy is listed as being food. And having worked up a hearty appetite in the great outdoors, apparently Giacomo Lenmano is justly famed for his excellent pizzas. As a philosopher, Jimmy has a great fondness for nonsense and the rhymes of Hilaire Belloc and Edward Lear. In Hilaire Belloc's Cautionary Tales for Children, we learn some more about Jim and that his love of food goes way beyond his own pizzas. Belloc writes, "There was a boy whose name was Jim. His friends were very good to him. They gave him tea and cakes and jam and slices of delicious ham and chocolate with pink inside and little tricycles to ride, and read him stories through and through, and even took him to the zoo, and there it was the dreadful fate befell him, which I now relate." Well, Jim's dreadful fate for this evening is to have to spend it with us. You can be assured, however, that there will be no more nonsense from now on as I hand over the platform to Professor Jimmy Lenman, who perhaps while simultaneously riding a little tricycle, as in the rhyme, will make ethics intelligible.
Was our country's decision to go to war in Iraq a grave moral wrong? More generally, in what circumstances is it morally permissible, consistent with justice, for one country to make war on another? What moral constraints exist on the conduct of wars? Is terrorism ever defensible? Are there any acceptable forms of discrimination on grounds of race or sex? And if so, what are they? Is it sometimes acceptable deliberately to end a person's life at their own request in order to free them from suffering? What moral constraints are in place on how we may treat various species of non-human animals, or on how we may treat unborn human beings at various stages of their development? Is it a grave injustice that some are wealthy while others are poor? Does it make a difference why those who are wealthy or poor are wealthy or poor? And what difference might that be? What are the right moral constraints to impose upon sexual behaviour? Was the ideal of free love really such a good idea? If appropriate hygienic and, where appropriate, contraceptive precautions are in place, is sexual intercourse between siblings or with animals really so bad? And if so, why? Is it morally wrong to fantasise about performing sexual acts such as rape that it would certainly be morally wrong to perform? Is it morally wrong for pornography to facilitate such fantasy by depicting such actions? Is every kind of pornography morally wrong? When is the punishment of wrongdoing unjustly harsh? When unjustly lenient? What circumstances might properly exculpate people from blame for various kinds of wrongdoing? Might they include circumstances of duress, or provocation, or involuntary intoxication by alcohol or drugs? When and how can we acceptably censor the press and the arts? Moral or ethical thought is the business of thinking about questions such as these. We have quite enough to keep us busy, even before observing that the list I just gave is only the tiniest sample. Moral philosophy, the part of philosophy in which I specialise, concerns itself with questions such as these in two ways. One is by trying to answer them, and that's something I've dabbled in from time to time. Another way, a way that preoccupies me rather more, is in trying to make sense of them. What kind of questions are these? Do they have right or wrong answers? Can we find out what these answers are? If so, how? If not, where is that supposed to leave us? Why are we even supposed to care about the answers to questions like these? I think these latter questions, the questions that comprise what's sometimes called meta-ethics, are quite hard. It would be simple enough if moral questions were straightforwardly empirical questions, but they don't seem to be. Determining whether euthanasia is wrong is not like determining that certain stars are further away than certain other stars, or determining in which substances other substances are or are not soluble, or of which plants the leaves are poisonous to which animals. Indeed, it is very hard to understand ethical questions as simply empirical questions about features of the natural world, straightforward or otherwise. Obviously, empirical questions about the natural world and moral questions are deeply mutually entangled. In deep, complex, and numerous ways, empirical questions about the natural world are extremely relevant to moral questions. Countless questions of fact may be highly relevant to the very particular questions I began by listing. Does pornography do real harm? And if so, how much? How effective in practice are highly punitive systems of criminal law? But such questions of relevance are themselves thick with ethical presupposition. For a pure retributivist, questions about the deterrent effects of harsh punishments are neither here nor there. Someone who conducts lethal experiments on rabbits might seek to defend what she does by appealing to the benefits that arise from the ensuing gains to medical knowledge. But if the Nazi doctor who has conducted painful, degrading, lethal, or crippling experiments on human subjects seeks to defend his actions in this way, we reject what he says. Not because we necessarily contest the facts he adduces, but because we think his considering them relevant at all shows us that he doesn't get it. He doesn't properly understand the moral gravity of what he has done if he thinks it can be defended in that way. I think we're right to think that. But it's very hard to see how we might, say, design an experiment that would test that hypothesis. At a higher level of empirical generality, at a higher level of theoretical generality, it is to at least a great extent an empirical question what makes for human happiness and well-being. But it's not at all obviously an empirical question whether happiness and well-being are, in the last analysis, all that matters, morally speaking, as many people have contended and many others have denied. Notoriously, it seems quite possible that two people might, without confusion, be in complete agreement about all the facts of how it is with the natural world and still disagree fundamentally about ethical questions. That's somewhat inconclusive. Certainly, numerous philosophers over recent centuries, notably David Hume, G.E. Moore, Richard Hare, and Alan Gibbard, have rehearsed considerations similar to these to oppose what is sometimes called ethical naturalism, a view which seeks to identify ethical facts with, or reduce them to, natural facts about the world apt for investigation by empirical science. Not everyone is persuaded. The arguments Hume and others employ can raise vexed questions in the philosophy of language and science, and certainly the most resourceful contemporary defenders of forms of ethical naturalism, such excellent philosophers as Frank Jackson, Peter Railton, and Judith Thompson, have rich and subtle ways of seeking to render this view plausible. That said, it is Hume, Moore, Hare, and Gibbard who have me persuaded that moral questions are not simply empirical questions about how things are with the natural world. Good ethics is highly attentive to science, but ethics is not science. To say that is to recognise what is sometimes called the autonomy of ethics, the autonomy of ethics. Ethics is ethics, not something else. It's not psychology. It's not evolutionary biology. It's not economics. When people try to make ethics any of these things, all they succeed in doing is changing the subject. So if moral questions are not, or not simply, questions about the natural world, an obvious move is to wonder if perhaps they are questions about some other domain of reality, out with the natural. Perhaps a theological domain. It's rather debatable, of course, that reality has any such domain out with the natural. But perhaps it's a matter of some moral urgency that we should believe it does. In debates about theism, we often encounter the thought that we need God to somehow shore morality up with the authority he alone is able to invest in it. If God is dead, we are often invited to fear. Everything is permitted. And the thought is usually presented precisely as something to be feared, something threatening, not say as something liberating and welcome. If God is dead, everything is permitted. And that would be just awful. Sometimes, indeed, this is presented as an argument for the retention of religious belief. We should continue to believe in God to avert the catastrophe of making nonsense of ethics that would follow from disbelief. Of course, this is not a good argument. The standard worry that gets raised about it is the so-called Euthyphro dilemma. Does God, this dilemma asks us, issue the moral commands he does for some good reasons? If not, his commands seem utterly arbitrary. But if so, then it's surely those good reasons, and not his commands, that provide the fundamental source for the authority of moral norms. Here's a different way to come at what is essentially the same thought. just why? It's illuminating, I think, to ask. Just why would it be a catastrophe if all the moral constraints and demands we take to apply to us were to cease to be credible in this way? Why is that something to fear? Why would losing morality be any real loss? If there's some reason to think it would, it's either a reason that's independent of the truth of theism, or it's not. If the reason to think losing morality would be catastrophic is a reason independent of the truth of theism, then surely we don't need theism to avoid the feared catastrophe. For any consideration that provided us with a reason to think the discrediting of moral norms would be a catastrophe is liable also to provide us with a reason to value, respect, and retain those very norms. And if we have a reason to do that, we've averted the catastrophe. Whereas if the only reason we have to think losing morality would be catastrophic, it's self-derived from the importance God's will has bestowed upon morality, any argument for theism that appealed to that importance would beg the question. Not only would God's demise mean that what would otherwise be forbidden was suddenly permitted, it would also mean that what would otherwise be a catastrophe was in fact no catastrophe at all. This sort of thing is always happening. We are presented with some metaphysical proposition, P, and we are told that if P is false, morality is nonsense, and that would be awful. So we better believe that P is true. P might be, and often is, the truth of theism. Or it might be, and often is, some extravagant proposition about the metaphysics of free will. The question we always need to ask here is why it would be terrible to make nonsense of ethics, and I think getting clear why it would be terrible is exactly what we need to do to make sense of ethics. And when we do this, I think what we discover is that we have, after all, no need of the metaphysical proposition P to make all the sense we need. For after all, the thought that losing ethics would be a terrible thing is already an ethical thought. A thought you need already to have ethics, even to think. Ethics is often situated out with the domain of the natural in ways that make no reference to theology. Here, the big picture of moral philosophy takes on a shape that is a commonplace of much contemporary philosophy as a whole. Some central feature of our world, such as ethical values, numbers, or thoughts, starts to look philosophically problematic. How on earth, people have wondered, could the natural world, the empirical world studied by science, possibly incorporate, for example, numbers? If we are to believe physicists, the stuff from which the natural world is composed is made out of atoms. But abstract things like numbers surely cannot be made out of atoms. They just don't look as if they fit as part of the natural, empirical world. Likewise, it is sometimes argued with conscious thought, likewise with ethics. So we get a bunch of people, dualists about the mind, Platonists, as they're called sometimes, about numbers, non-naturalists, as they're called about ethics, ethical non-naturalists, who say, okay, these things are not part of the natural empirical world. But that's okay, because the natural empirical world is not all there is. There's another domain, perhaps the domain of numbers, or the domain of ethical truth, that's not part of this natural order of causally interacting physical things, but somehow distinct from it. But then, of course, there's other people who say, no, this sort of non-naturalist view is just silly. A lot of spooky nonsense. After all, if truths about, say, numbers or ethical values really were so divorced from the natural world at which our empirical experience is directed, it begins to look very mysterious how we could know about them, how we could even speak about them, and indeed, why we should care about them. So some people persevere in trying to find something in the natural world with which to identify such things. Others, despairing of this whole game, consider more radical possibilities for mathematics or ethics. Maybe it's all just garbage. Maybe there actually aren't any truths about these things. It's like fairies and phlogiston, stuff we used to believe in. But if we are rational, if we are sensible, we will just stop believing in all this stuff, much as we just stopped believing in the gods of Mount Olympus. I'm not, as I've said, an ethical naturalist. I don't think ethics is science. I'm not a non-naturalist either. Is there a domain of non-natural ethical facts that the questions I began by listing are questions about? Well, one good objection to non-naturalism is that it's very hard to see how we could ever know. Our senses are physical processes. How could they ever tell us about anything that wasn't physical? And if they don't tell us, what does? Some people say moral intuition, but that's just a placeholder for an answer, not an answer. If nothing more is said, and usually nothing more is. So one objection to non-naturalism is that it's hard to understand how we could ever know there was such a domain. Perhaps there is, or perhaps there is not. I have no idea. And the fact is, you know, I don't care. And I don't think you should care either. It's really just the Euthyphro dilemma all over again. Here's a thought experiment. Suppose you believed there were sentences written on the sky that said, don't kill, don't steal, don't torture, don't rape. Then you might come to think the prohibition of these things drew its authority from the presence on the sky of these sentences. But you'd be wrong. After all, suppose we discovered there were sentences written in the sky that said the opposite of these things. do kill, do steal, do torture, would we then think it was okay or desirable to do these things? No. We would think, how odd. There appear to be some rather obnoxious and stupid sentences written in the sky, and we would take no further notice of them. Another thought experiment. Consider the facts that make up the historical narrative of the Nazi Holocaust. Now imagine a world in which all that stuff occurs exactly as it did in our world. The planning, the preparation, the pain, the suffering, the killing, all that and everything else exactly as it actually unfolded. Only imagine, please, one teeny difference. In our world, it is a non-natural fact that those who planned and carried out all that stuff did something wrong. In this world, it isn't. Change nothing else. So in this world, the non-natural facts have been inverted. And this is an imaginary world. I'm the author of this fiction. Authors can do what they like. So imagine such a world. A world in which planning and executing the attempted extermination of the Jewish population of a continent is morally permissible, or even morally admirable. Well, you can try conceiving of that, but I think you will fail. Because nothing about any supposed non-natural moral facts could conceivably subtract from the wickedness of the Holocaust. And no less plausibly, nothing about such supposed non-natural moral facts could conceivably contribute to it. That's why I don't care about non-natural moral facts, and why I don't think morality has anything remotely to do with them. Say this, and once again the pessimistic alarm bell is sounded. It's about to be sounded at some length in a forthcoming book by Derek Parfitt. Morality only makes sense, we're sometimes told, if we accept that these non-natural facts obtain. Give up on them and we give up on morality itself. And once again, that would be awful. Again, I think we need to be told why. What would be so awful about it? Perhaps it would be awful because we have some reason to value morality. A reason having nothing to do with all this tosh about non-natural facts. And if we have such a reason, morality is not threatened by giving up on the tosh. So again, I'm not troubled by the pessimistic alarm bell. Perhaps you think I should be. After all, I've explained that I don't think morality consists in a bunch of natural facts. Facts about the natural empirical world investigated by science. I went on to explain that I don't think morality consists in a bunch of non-natural facts about some other domain of reality, some strange non-natural domain. Doesn't that leave me with nothing to say, except that morality consists in nothing at all? Doesn't that make me a sceptic about the moral, committed to saying we should just give it all up, put it quietly to bed with Hephaestus, Hades, Demeter, Ares, Athena, Hera, and Zeus? there's plenty of this about. There's plenty of people confronted with ethical questions, ready to consist that it is all garbage, a tissue of metaphysically fanciful falsehood. The best way to see why we shouldn't believe that is to try, seriously to try, to believe it. Where would it leave us if ethics was just garbage? Presumably with the thought that we should just abandon it, abolish it. And some people have urged that we should, and have sought to paint the idea that we should in an attractive light. Not only, people have urged, is morality garbage, but it's harmful garbage that we would be better off without. Morality, people urge, some people, makes us priggish, sanctimonious, censorious, prudish, punitive, pompous, mean-spirited, fanatical, and cruel. Just getting rid of it would be a huge liberation. There's a problem with reasoning like that. And the problem, of course, is that when someone condemns morality for making us priggish, sanctimonious, censorious, prudish, punitive, pompous, mean-spirited, fanatical, or cruel, he's engaged in a familiar activity with a familiar name. He's moralizing. It makes sense to dislike these things. And it makes sense to recognize that they can all wear the front of morality, that vile things are done in the name of ethics. Uli Edel's excellent recent film about the Red Army faction, the Bader-Meinhof complex, documents a particularly spectacular example of precisely that, rather vividly. But that's not an objection to ethics any more than the existence of bad music is a reason to dislike music, or the fact that liberal-mindedness sometimes leads people to say or do stupid things is an objection to liberalism. It's an objection to bad ethics and to the stupid, twisted and pathological forms of motivation the stupid, twisted and pathological forms that moral motivation, like any kind of motivation, can sometimes take. It may favour reform, but it doesn't favour abolition. A year or so ago, I heard a radio debate in which one-time Liberal front bencher Mark Oldham boldly and controversially announced that he would defend the bold and controversial proposition that we should abolish prisons. A proposition so bold and controversial, he proudly told us, that it was only since leaving the Liberal front benches that he felt he dared advance it at all. Prisons, he told us, should be abolished, and they should be replaced with a new range of tools for dealing with criminality more suited to the 21st century. But any inclination one might have had to be impressed at the bold and controversial character of it all rather evaporated when it became clear that this new range of tools would include special buildings with locks on the doors and guards where people with a history of criminal behaviour would spend periods of confinement. But they wouldn't be prisons, no, please, detention centres, okay? In a like way, the moral abolitionist is surely either not thinking clearly, or just having us on. Perhaps I do him too little credit. Perhaps he means it. But what would meaning it involve? There are many vexed and controversial ethical questions. I began by listing a whole bunch. But there are also many that are not controversial. How willing would you be to agree to live in a society where murder was simply okay? How willing would you be to agree to live in a society where torture was simply okay? Not arguably okay in some kind of special ticking bomb fancy circumstances, but just okay. I kind of enjoy it. That'll do for a reason. How willing would you be to agree to live in a society where rape was simply okay? How willing would you be to agree to live in a society where any appeal in any context to considerations of fairness and justice was simply not recognised as carrying any kind of rational force at all? Some people might be willing to agree to all these things. And people like that might be serious moral abolitionists. But I'm not willing to accept these things. And neither are you. But how then are we to make sense of morality? If we can't take it to consist either in a domain of natural facts or in a domain of non-natural facts, doesn't ruling these things out rule out everything? Well, I don't think it is. But let's see where we've got. Given what I've said so far, I suggest that what we want is a meta-ethical account of what ethics might be, how ethical claims can be understood, that satisfies three desiderata. It should firstly respect the autonomy of ethics. Ethics is ethics, not something else, not science. Secondly, it should be consistent with a broad metaphysical naturalism. It shouldn't need us to take on any more in the way of metaphysical baggage than good science already supplies. Thirdly, it shouldn't simply debunk morality. It would be nice if there was a meta-ethical theory that ticked all those three boxes, that respected the autonomy of ethics, that was consistent with a broad metaphysical naturalism, and that didn't just chuck ethics out as a load of garbage. Happily, there is one. And I think there's only one that is remotely credible. View that if you want to tick those three boxes, as far as I know, is the only game in town. And this is the meta-ethical view that's sometimes called expressivism. Expressivists don't think morality consists in a domain of natural facts. They don't think it consists in a domain of non-natural facts. And they don't think it's garbage. According to expressivists, when I say something you have done is wrong, I'm not describing it by imputing some natural property to it. There are many natural properties, but wrongness is not one of them. Nor am I describing it by imputing some non-natural property to it. Because there aren't any. non-natural properties. And this looks like it's making nonsense of what I'm saying until we remind ourselves that describing things is only one of the many things we use language to do. When I asked you if you'd be willing to agree to live in a society where certain grim things were okay, I wasn't asking you to sign up to belief in some proposition. I was asking what you'd be willing to do. What practices, not what beliefs, what practices you would be willing to sign up to. On the expressivist account I defend, what I'm doing when I say that what you did was wrong is roughly this. I'm expressing my unwillingness to accept, as a set of rules governing my community, any such set which permitted people to do stuff like that. My unwillingness to accept as a set of rules governing my community, any such set which permitted people to do stuff like that. That's an expression of a state of mind that is fundamentally not cognitive. An unwillingness is a kind of desire, not a kind of belief. I'm not willing to accept a normative constitution for my society, a set of rules to govern my society, where murder, torture, and rape are all okay. And when I say these things are wrong, it is this unwillingness that I express by my words. And this unwillingness is not hostage to any remotely contentious metaphysical theories. Any stuff about God, any stuff about non-natural facts, any stuff about free will. It's quite robust in the face of changes in whether I believe in a God or whether I believe there are any non-natural facts or anything of that kind. It's simply an emotional response to things that I find hateful. Now, here's a lucky thing. This very stable and robust emotional response I have to murder, torture, and rape is very widely shared. I hate these things, and so does almost everybody else. You all, I confidently conjecture, agree with me about this, as well as about an absolutely vast amount of other stuff. The list of relatively vexatious, relatively difficult questions with which I began is in a way misleading, paints a false picture. For while there is much in morality that is controversial and difficult, and the focus of disagreement, there's also a vast amount that is simply platitudinous. And what that means is that we can have a go at making a moral community together. A community governed by moral rules, which demand of us that we respect the things we agree in wanting to see respected, and prohibit the things we agree in wanting to see prohibited. We think this is all a very good idea, because it serves ends we care about profoundly. We don't think it's a good idea because we believe some metaphysical propositions. Indeed, we don't fundamentally, in the last analysis, think it's a good idea because of our beliefs at all,
but because of our
desires, the passions of our souls. These desires, the desires we express when we say that we have the reason we do to think losing morality would be catastrophic, aren't hostage to any metaphysical beliefs about non-natural facts or stuff like that. The important project of saving and sustaining morality is a real and important project. But it's not a metaphysical project at all. It's a political project.
Water.
Nearly done. Because we agree on so much, we're able to at least have a go at constituting a moral community. And that's nice. A welcome fact. Here's another one. Another very welcome thing. Because we agree on so much, it's possible, usually, for us to have conversations with each other about the stuff we don't agree about. Often, indeed, these disagreements can simply be settled by getting clear what the facts are, for, as I said at the outset, empirical questions about the natural world and moral questions are deeply mutually entangled. But even where our disagreements are morally substantive, they may still be tractable. You might take as inputs the things I'm in agreement with you about, and then appeal to them in seeking me to see in a different light some issue that I currently don't agree with you about. Proceeding like that is often characterised as involving appeal to things called intuitions, the status and authority of which can easily seem vexed and mysterious. But that's just a misunderstanding. It's wholly proper in moral argument to appeal to intuitions, but intuitions are fundamentally not beliefs at all. Rather, they're shared commitments on which we seek to build. Commitments reflection on which can, on a good day, help us to deepen our moral commonalities and improve, by our own lights, our moral sensibilities. In a way, this just recapitulates Hume, the guy I read when I need reminding why I love philosophy. Take any action, Hume writes, allowed to be vicious. Willful murder, for instance. Examine it in all lights and see if you can find that matter of fact or real existence which you call vice. In whichever way you take it, you find only certain passions, motives, volitions and thoughts. There is no other matter of fact in the case. The vice escapes you. The vice entirely escapes you. Oh dear. The vice entirely escapes you, so long as you consider the object. You can never find it till you turn your reflection into your own breast and find a sentiment of disapprobation which arises in you towards this action. But to illustrate expressivism with this wonderful passage, and Hume probably wasn't quite what we would now call an expressivist, to illustrate expressivism with this passage might risk misunderstanding. Aren't I now saying that really a sort of ethical naturalism is true after all? That ethics, after all, is just psychology? No, I'm not.
When I say murder is wrong, I am, to be sure, expressing a feature of my psychology. That's true and utterly uninteresting. When I say anything, I'm expressing a feature of my psychology. But when I say murder is wrong, I'm not describing my psychology. I'm not, as Simon Blackburn has emphasised, talking about myself at all. I'm not talking about myself at all. And Blackburn is right. After all, when I say murder is wrong, I say something you might, and I hope will, find yourself in a position to agree with. And to agree with me, you don't need to know anything about me. Another misunderstanding is that this roughly Humean expressivist view fails to meet my third desideratum. That it does, after all, amount to a form of debunking or trivialisation of ethics. If that's all ethics is, it can't be very important. It can't be very significant. If that's all it is, it's just a lot of emotional letting off of steam. Nothing to be taken seriously. People have aired such concerns, but I confess I don't really understand them. The trouble with you, Lehmann, is that you understand ethical discourse as expressing, negotiating, and extending in reasoned ways our deepest and most passionate commitments vis-à-vis the terms on which we human beings might be willing to live in community together. We, on the other hand, think it's about something important. I think that would be a very baffling thing for anyone to say. Thank you.